But still, I think that your presentation was pretty clear and the slides were readable, so to say, even if the topic you have treated might be very complicated for some of us, me included, I should say. But never, I mean, that was interesting. So may I start the period of questions? Just shout. Magda, can I see your hand? Was it your hand or
It
not?
was not meant like this, but I can definitely start. I have a
Okay.
question. So, I'm curious about the Syrian Arabic slide you had at the first part. If I'm not wrong, you said that you have an idea about some 60 plus languages in your analysis. So, do you expect that the Syrian Arabic picture, which is sort of puzzled, could be even worse in some other languages, or do you rather? I know it's a sort of speculation. Just do you think it's sort of coherent across languages, or some languages may go even further with this puzzling picture of how these pronouns and other words are used?
Thank you very much for the question. Indeed, it seems that the picture of Syrian Arabic that I'm giving you here is rather complex in a sense, in the way that these individual WH words behave rather differently from each other in this language. What is important is that despite these different behaviors, each of the individual WH words follows the same generalization that we saw cross-linguistically. That is the main sort of that's the core finding that is kind of satisfying, we could say. In fact, we chose the reason why I decided to choose Arabic vernaculars for an analysis of this kind is that I expected these kinds of complications in these dialects. The reason is that Arabic happens to be, or Arabic vernaculars happen to be, sort of somewhere between the very liberal kind of approach that most European languages take, and where WH words can be used across most of these constructions, and languages that do not allow for that almost at all. Another reason is that Arabic vernaculars often have optionality in where they place the interrogative pronouns, if they are placed clause initially, if they are placed WH ex situ or WH in situ. And this was also one of the reasons why I was wanted to look at Arabic, because if you have an optionality in the language, and if you have the optionality in the interrogative part, then in principle, these are good candidates to test the generalization that relative clauses always have to have WH ex situ, because these languages in principle allow for both, which is not the case of most European languages. So when it comes to this particular paradigm, I was very pleased to find this kind of complexity, because it shows that the paradigmatic relations between these different pronouns can be very complex, but despite this complexity, they can still follow the core generalization. And I expect to see maybe more of this in other types of Arabic vernaculars, not just Syrian, which is
Very
undergoing.
informative. Thank you.
Thank you. So, some further questions or comments or so in the meantime, I have a remark or a question. Just a couple of days ago, I listened to a talk where the person said that syntax or grammar actually brings many headaches to those who study semantics. And unfortunately, his advice was just we can we just stop looking at grammar and go straight to semantics. I think that your talk, in a way, suggested that the nanosyntactic analysis helps you to come to conclusions about the semantic, or at least about the hierarchy, which you presented at the end. Am I right, or is it not so?
Yes, I do think so. Even though it seems that, can you hear me? Am I back for you?
Okay. Yes, you are.
My Zoom switched off for a while. I do think that syntax is essential for semantics. I do not think that going directly to semantics and sidestepping syntax is a way to go, indeed. But in my case, it also might be a matter of personal taste, because I have seen so many convincing examples of how syntax and semantics closely collaborate with each other. You can indeed see the case that I've described as a case for a close syntax semantics relationship. Indeed, yes, I would agree.
Okay, thank you.
I think there was one question in the chat.
Please.
If the person wants to ask it, or I could also just answer.
Yes, please answer it. Or can you repeat it from the chat? Because maybe somebody hasn't read it in the chat. But.
Mm-hmm. So it disappeared for me now, unfortunately, as I got out of Zoom for a while. But I can. Maybe there is. There it is again. So the person who is asking is telling that he's unable or she's
yes,
unable
yes.
to use the microphone. So let me rephrase the question.
Yes, please.
So it concerned the Bulgarian pattern where there is this to attached to the WH word, and the person asked about. Whether this could be treated as a definite article, and this is indeed something that is very close to. This is something that should not be. It's pretty serious kind of candidate of analysis because these morphemes, these relative morphemes, are actually drafted. Typically from the demonstrative morphology. You can see that also in German for the das. But to is also morphologically related to definiteness. A is also in Hungarian is related to a definiteness or to the demonstrative pronoun. There's an analysis that it actually developed diachronically from that. Also the Greek pattern o is also the case. Not so, for example, for the Slovenian pattern kje versus kjer, where the r is not a definite article or demonstrative. It's more like a complementizer. So let me discuss that. We can't simply treat that in terms of its meaning as a definite article. An important piece of evidence against that, and that replicates from language to language, is that you can, and in fact you have to use these relative forms also for relative clauses that modify indefinite nominal phrases and even indefinite non-specific ones. So in Bulgarian, if you say something like, I'm looking for a secretary that would be a good addition to our department, this is indefinite and non-specific in the sense that I don't have a particular secretary in mind. And still in the relative clause that would be a good fit for our department, you would have to use the koito kind of pronoun, and you couldn't use just koi. Yeah. So the koito is an important point. It doesn't mark definiteness. It does something else semantically. And what I suggest is that it just marks a relation to, in these headed relative clauses at least, it marks a relation to an external determiner by which it is selected or to which it has a semantic relationship. And okay, and then I can see, the person who's asking, saying, I was referring to the particular slide where the to is reduplicated optionally. Okay, so we can get to that. Right, over here. So there is an optional presence of to on kogo in 27a versus 27b. Still, I don't quite see how this, like a definite analysis would be usable over here. If anything, then it seems that we have an association with a high scoping universal quantifier in the absence of to. In the first case, again, this is not really where we have to in both cases. This is not really about definiteness per se. It is translated as the person who has something hurting talks about it, but it's not the kind of definiteness that you would think of as standard definiteness. It's more like if a person has something hurting, then he talks about it. It's more like this kind of an interpretation. It's more like a generic interpretation, which in English happens to be expressible by a definite article. But it's not, I mean, it's not the standard kind of definiteness that you would employ over here in these kinds of examples. Okay. I guess I hope I answered the question more or less. If not, I'm sorry. Or I can see the chat is coming out.
Yeah, okay, so. It says, okay, thanks. So thank you. Thank you very much. Now, are there any hands or just
can I have a
yes,
question?
Please. Yeah. Sasha Rosen.
I'm sorry, I have to talk without the picture because...
No, it's fine, it's fine.
It's probably just a clarification question about the nanosyntactic analysis. There is some optionality in the data, right? And so how does it reflect in the analysis? It maybe I missed something, but it seemed to me like the analysis does not really reflect the optionality, but maybe it does.
Maybe one clarification question on my side to you. By optionality, you mean these brackets in the
right. So in some cells, you have two options, right?
Right. Yeah. So the answer to that is, like, the short answer would be I still have to do more research on this. I don't know what exactly is going on. It will very probably be different things in different languages and in different constructions. My hunch from the relatively little that I know is that semantics is playing an important role here. So we already saw that for correlatives in Hungarian, where if you have a correlative where you don't use the a, then it necessarily has the semantics of a proverb. The interesting thing is that if you ask native speakers, or at least the native speaker that I consulted, she said that if you form a non-proverbial, a new kind of correlative in Hungarian using just ki, then you necessarily interpret it as a proverb. So you sort of have to add this kind of interpretation. Then I have no idea, I have to admit, I have no idea what the semantics let alone the syntax of a proverb should be like the formal semantics in terms of the truth conditions and presuppositions. I really don't know. It seems to me that I've always thought that proverbs are more of a use dependent thing than a syntax semantics thing. And this is also maybe it's just that, maybe it's just the kind of a construction in the construction grammar sense, where if you use the WH word without the A, it just is a proverb. Okay, so this might be the case of Hungarian. For unconditionals, koi and koito in Bulgarian or in Hindi, with the optionality between y and k, my hunch about that from what I know is that this really might be a hidden difference between an unconditional and a correlative of sorts. So this might be, I would have to look at the examples better, but it seems that if you don't have the to, it really seems that it comes closer to the unconditional. And if you have the to, it would be a correlative. And this, of course, makes some predictions. And I still would have to test those predictions. So that would mean that the optionality is not a true optionality. It reflects the structural and semantic properties of the individual relative constructions. And this should be testable empirically, ideally.
Okay, and so you think that there would be really no optionality even in other languages, like including Arabic,
I don't know. I wouldn't rule out optionality altogether. Not at all. I'm a person who can live with optionality fairly well. We just would have to think of like the optionality in the nanosyntactic analysis would really be that you have one syntactic representation corresponding to two different lexical items. It's possible that this happens. And I have seen genuine, like outside of the realm of relative clauses, I have seen many examples that convinced me that optionality is a thing in the grammar. I think it can happen, but it's just the thing that maybe speakers in general don't really like. So if they see something optional, they start looking for differences that they could exploit in functional ways. So maybe optionality doesn't survive very long, diachronically speaking. But of course, it's an important diachronic device. So once you have something optional, you sort of predict into the future. You predict a certain diachronic step, for example, but the diachronic step assumes that the optional stage could be there before that in a way. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So I can't see any question or
hand. I have another question on.
Oh, yes.
On this slide that's currently on the shared screen.
Okay. This
hierarchy, I didn't quite get what is the supposed difference between Czech and Abaza on the two ends of it? Because there's essentially, my interpretation would be that there is no change of the coding.
Mm-hmm. I fully agree with you, and thank you for that. That might be true. This might be just a remnant of descriptive analyses. So if you wish, then, in the Czech system, you can see pretty clearly that WH words are primarily interrogative. You don't see that for kde, but you can see it for other WH words, which cannot be used in, say, in some relative functions, say, okay. So it's, for example, difficult to create a headed relative with kolik, okay? So kolik is just interrogative. It probably can be correlative, but it's probably very hard to make it headed relative. So you can see it with other WH words. Then for Abaza, there's in principle two options. Either this is primarily an interrogative form, or it's primarily a relative form that sort of spreads all the way to the interrogative. The second approach, that it's primarily a relative form, is what has been taken in the analytic, in the descriptive grammars, where people have treated this y prefix. It's in fact a prefix on the verb. It's not even a self-standing morpheme, it's a prefix on the verb, so that this prefix has been treated as primarily relative, and this also has been adopted in the formal analyses of this, where people have just said, okay, what Abaza does is that it creates interrogatives by using relative clauses. So if they want to ask something like, what did you see, then they would say, the thing you saw, and this they would sort of expect, and there is probably an additional I'm pretty sure about that, there is an additional interrogative morpheme that expresses the force, so you say the thing you saw, and then sort of a interrogative force morpheme, and that tells the hearer that the speaker is expecting an answer. And so if this is right, then there is a qualitative difference between Czech and Abaza. But I think ultimately what could decide between these two things would be looking at acquisition. I would be really curious, really interested to see how Abaza kids learn this morpheme, because what you see for WH words across languages is that kids start by learning the interrogative function first. This is also what we are testing together with Klára Matyáš-Suvicová for Czech and for English. You start with the interrogative and you go on deeper to the headed relative. If this ye morpheme in Abaza is primarily interrogative, then kids should start using it in interrogatives first. If it's primarily relative, then probably they should start using it in relatives first. So this is one way of testing the difference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Some other questions? Well, if nobody raises his hand or is shouting, then I would like to pass over the microphone to Magda and ask her to tell us what are the fresh news about the next Monday seminar.
Okay. Once more, many thanks to Radek for giving the lecture in here. Next week, we have, I would say, in-house lecture, however, still via Zoom. It's by Šárka Zikánová, who will talk about implicit discourse relations in psycholinguistic experiments. So it's starting at 2 p.m. on Monday next week.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So I would like to thank Radek Šimík again for coming here and giving us his nice talk and proposing a different view than we are used to, perhaps, but still it's very interesting to see. And I would like to invite all of you to our next Monday seminar with Šárka Zikánová talk on discourse. So thank you and see you next week.
Thank you very much as well.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye.